The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, this is our third week of the introduction to Buddhist teachings. And I wanted to begin with a little bit of a recap of what we've talked about for the last 2 weeks. Did everybody here get the syllabus? Anybody not get the course outline? Okay. Sometimes the Buddha said, "All that I teach is suffering and the end of suffering." Essentially, all of the teachings of the Buddha can fit under this heading of suffering and the end of suffering. And through the Four Noble Truths, these teachings are explored in a little more detail. The truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of the cessation of suffering, and the truth of the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Each of these truths has an action associated with it. So these are not truths that are meant to be just believed in a sense of just, these are truths that you're supposed to take in and just believe. They are meant to be acted on. They are meant to be lived truths. So the truth of suffering is meant to be understood. And the truth of the cause of suffering, the craving, is meant to be let go of. So through the exploration of suffering, the Buddha teaches, "All that I teach is suffering and the end of suffering." The exploration of suffering, the exploration understanding suffering, and the exploration of the cause of suffering, the craving, the wanting things to be other than they are. If we can let go of that wanting and completely understand the suffering, by understanding the suffering, we mean really understanding how it comes to be. What are the conditions, the causes that bring it together, including the craving. When we really understand suffering, we experience the end of suffering. If we let go of the cause of suffering, we experience the end of suffering. So in the actual understanding of suffering is its release. The way to understand suffering and to let go of its cause, to let go of the wanting, these aren't simply things that we can usually just sit down and do right off the bat. They take some training. They take mental training to be able to explore these things in our experience. When we first sit down and explore suffering, mostly what we do is we bounce off of it. We're not particularly interested in understanding it. We want to get rid of it. So it takes some mental training to learn what it means to explore suffering, to learn what it means to let go of the cause of suffering. Because that letting go of the cause of suffering also isn't something that we do. It's not something that we say, okay, I'm going to let go of this. It's more a process that unfolds as we observe the wanting itself. So we observe our suffering, we observe the wanting, and the tool, the main tool that the Buddha taught for this observation is mindfulness. And the three aspects of the Eightfold Path, effort, mindfulness, and concentration, are the tools that allow us to explore our suffering, to let go of the cause of suffering. So without these tools of mindfulness, concentration, and effort, the practice is pretty much a mental exercise. It's not a lived experience. So the practice that the Buddha taught is really a path of living, not something just to believe or something to just think about, but actually something to engage in moment to moment in our lives. So the path leading to the end of suffering, the fourth noble truth, is meant to be cultivated. We cultivate the qualities that support our exploration of suffering and the end of suffering. We cultivate the qualities of non-harming that I talked about last week, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood. And we cultivate the meditative ability to stabilize and be present for our experience in the present moment. So the promise of Buddhism is that if we cultivate these qualities, if we cultivate the qualities of ethical conduct and of mental cultivation, that this will lead us to a deep happiness, a happiness that is not dependent on the external circumstances of the world. It's not dependent on conditions. This is really a discussion of the third noble truth, the ending of suffering. This happiness that is the goal, in a sense, of the Buddhist path is the ending of suffering. Often called nirvana, which is the Sanskrit term for enlightenment or freedom from suffering, or nibbana in Pali, the Pali term for that same word, nibbana or nirvana. The term itself, the word, means something like to go out, to cool, as in a fire going out. The most concise definition of that term in the texts, in the Buddhist texts, is the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, and the absence of delusion. These are three qualities I've been talking about a lot in these past few weeks: greed, aversion, and delusion. We've talked about them in terms of understanding what's skillful in our actions, what's skillful in terms of leading us away from suffering, non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. When we act out of greed, aversion, and delusion, we tend to suffer. So the claim here is that the complete eradication of greed, aversion, and delusion is enlightenment. It's not some mystical, magical state of bells and whistles and lights. It's the absence of greed, aversion, and delusion. There are several texts that talk about nibbana, and these come from different sources, but I'm going to read them to you. I like the way they flow together. So this just gives you a little bit of a sense from the texts about this word, nibbana. The extinction of greed, the extinction of hate, the extinction of delusion, This indeed is called Nibbana. Enraptured with lust, enraged with anger, blinded by delusion, overwhelmed, with mind ensnared, man aims at his own ruin, at the ruin of others, at the ruin of both, and he experiences mental pain and grief. But if lust, anger, and delusion are given up, man aims neither at his own ruin, nor at the ruin of others, nor at the ruin of both, and he experiences no mental pain and grief. This is Nibbana, immediate, visible in this life, inviting, attractive, and comprehensible to the wise. And for a disciple thus freed, in whose heart dwells peace, there is nothing to be added to what has been done, and naught more remains for him to do. Just as a rock of one solid mass remains unshaken by the wind, even so neither forms, nor sounds, nor odors, nor tastes, nor contacts of any kind, neither the desired nor the undesired, can cause such a one to waver. Steadfast is the mind, gained is deliverance. This is peace, this is exquisite, the resolution of all fabrications, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, cessation, Nibbana. The texts also give a number of similes for Nibbana that put together, they kind of make a nice little poetic experience. So I'll read this to you as well. The unfashioned, the end, the effluentless, the true, the beyond, the subtle, the very hard to see, the ageless, permanence, the undecaying, the featureless, non-differentiation, peace, the deathless, the exquisite, bliss, solace, the exhaustion of craving, the wonderful, the marvelous, the secure, security, Nibbana, the unafflicted, the passionless, the pure, release, non-attachment, the island, shelter, harbor, refuge, the ultimate. So perhaps these descriptions sound a little remote, hard to fathom, or not really relevant to our daily experience. The texts describe the process of waking up, of coming to this realization of Nibbana, of the eradication of greed, aversion, and delusion, as a process. It's not usually something that is said to happen in one moment, although it apparently did for the Buddha. But in general, the texts describe a process that happens over a period of time. There's said to be four stages of enlightenment. The first stage, and at each of these stages, it's said that more and more things are let go of the aspects of greed, aversion, and delusion. And more subtle layers of greed, aversion, and delusion are let go of at each of these stages of enlightenment. At the first stage of enlightenment, it's said that doubt in the teachings is eliminated. Attachment to rites and rituals, attachment to believing that doing some action is going to free your mind, that is let go of. That in fact, the Buddhist teachings say that if you believe in rites and rituals, it's actually an impediment to your freeing yourself, because you can engage in a rite mostly you're engaging, people engage in these rites and rituals through an idea of gaining something. So letting go of this, and this was apparently in the time of the Buddha, rites and rituals were a very common way for people to express their spiritual practice. Bathing in the river Ganges, burning certain herbs, doing things to believing that this would free them. So letting go of that attachment to rites and rituals. And the third is letting go of identity view, the belief that there is a person here doing things, experiencing things. This one we'll talk a little bit more about later. So at the first stage of enlightenment, those things are said to be released. At the second stage of enlightenment, they're said to just be an attenuation of greed, aversion, and delusion. Nothing particularly is released at the second stage of enlightenment. At the third stage of enlightenment, it's said that sense desire and ill will are eliminated. So any attachment to the sense world is released at the third stage of enlightenment. And yet there are still subtle desires and aversions remaining in the mind. At the fourth stage of enlightenment, it's said that subtle desires for meditative states are eliminated, and conceit, restlessness, and ignorance are eliminated. These things that are eliminated, this list of things that are eliminated that I just listed, is a list called the 10 fetters. These are the 10 things that are said to tie us to non-release, essentially, to tie us to this wheel. Yeah, did you have a question? Just the second stage of enlightenment. The second stage of enlightenment is basically just a lessening of greed, aversion, and delusion. Nothing in particular extra is released. That's what it says in the texts. This is all from the texts here, what I'm saying, not from personal experience. The fourth and fifth are sense, desire, and ill will. I'm not sure which order they are. The fourth and fifth are eliminated at the third stage. Sense, desire, and ill will. Those are eliminated at the third stage. It's amazing to me that the third stage of enlightenment is that there's this letting go happens in these stages. And so, you know, you can be pretty enlightened and still attached to sense pleasure. So this is something for all of us to recognize, you know, that we're going to be attached to sense pleasure for a while. It's not a mistake if you're still feeling like you're attached to sense pleasure. Yeah, is there a question over here?
In the fourth stage, what are the 10 things you...
Okay, the let's see. So I'll list the 10 fetters. So the first three... The first three are doubt, attachments to rites and rituals, and identity view. And they are released at the first stage. The fourth and fifth fetters are sense, desire, and ill will. They're released at the third stage of enlightenment. And the last five fetters are released at the fourth stage of awakening. And they are two forms of subtle desire for meditative states, the desire for the formless existence, the form realm, and the desire for the formless realm, which are some subtle meditative states. Then there's conceit, restlessness, and ignorance. Now, conceit here is the idea of comparing, essentially, that I am greater than, less than, or equal to someone else, and that it includes this subtle notion that I am. Conceit basically includes this notion that I am. So even at the fourth stage of, before the final awakening, there's still some sense that I am. So this, I like looking at this teaching because it really points out that this is a process. It's a long process for most of us. It's not something that happens like this. And there's another analogy that's given in the text that I really love that is another way to see or to look at the gradual nature of this awakening process. The Buddha talks about a ship that has been pulled up onto land for the season, and that the rigging on that ship, the ropes on that ship, are attacked by the sun, the sand, the wind, water, rain. They get soggy, they dry out, the wind, the sun. And slowly over time, those ropes, that rigging, rots. And he compares the gradual rotting away of that rope to the way that the fetters are eliminated. If you think about that, if you think about it day by day, you're not going to be seeing much change in how those ropes look. But very slowly over time, they get worn away. And that's the way the practice works. It's a slow process over time. The application of our effort, our mindfulness, and our concentration slowly acts like the sun, the sand, the wind on those ropes. Slowly wears away at our clinging, our holding to things of the world. So over time, this is a process. Over time, we gain more of an understanding of the first two aspects of the Eightfold Path, wise understanding and wise intention. And really, this whole process can be thought of, as I said last time, it's said to be the Eightfold Path, so all of these are folded on top of each other. So there's a way in which we start the path, as I mentioned last week, we start the path with some understanding, a little understanding of suffering and some impetus towards finding a way out of suffering, some impetus towards freedom. So we start with some inkling maybe of a possibility of something different, a different way of living our lives. And through engaging in the practice, we gain a little bit of wisdom, which adds more impetus to the process, which gains more wisdom, which adds more impetus to the process. And so we just keep going around in this process. It's not a one-shot thing. It's a long process. And so over time, through bringing our mindfulness to our experience, turning our attention to our present moment experience, that's really how the wearing away happens. When we turn our mindfulness to present moment experience, that's where the wearing away of these fetters happens. And we start to understand some of what the Buddha is talking about. So we start to gain some wisdom. So today, mostly I want to talk about some of the aspects of wisdom. What it is that we begin to understand as we engage in this practice. So there's several main ways that this wisdom or wise understanding is defined in the texts, in the Buddhist texts. It's defined as understanding the Four Noble Truths. It's defined as understanding what is skillful and what is unskillful. Where skillful and unskillful, again, as I mentioned before, skillful actions are those that are made from non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. So understanding essentially how greed, aversion, and delusion lead to suffering and how non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion leads us out of suffering, that's an understanding of what's skillful and what's unskillful. An understanding of karma that causes and conditions create our experience. That as we act out of greed, aversion, and delusion, those causes lead us towards suffering. As we act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, those causes lead us out of suffering. So that process of karma, how karma works, an understanding of that, we begin to move in the direction that leads us away from suffering. So I talked some about karma the first week. I talked some about skillful and unskillful actions both the first and the second weeks. The Four Noble Truths I've been talking about as we go. Then there are two more ways that wisdom, wise understanding is approached. An understanding of impermanence, suffering, and not self. This is the understanding of anicca, dukkha, anatta. Three terms that if you hang around here much, you will hear. Anicca means impermanent. Dukkha means suffering. Anatta means not self. Another aspect of wise understanding that I don't think I wrote down on today's list is understanding how the whole process of suffering comes into being through a process called dependent origination. That I will say for next week. Today I'm going to mostly focus on anicca, dukkha, anatta. But before I go there, are there any questions? Yeah.
I wonder why the Pali terms are used, because there evidently are good translations for those words that we understand. And somehow adding the Pali term distances Americans, I think, English speakers, from it. And it makes it seem like some far off exotic, mystical something, which it really isn't.
No, it's not.
But interjecting those words. So I'm wondering why, and I've heard all the teachers do it, I just wonder why it's necessary.
Well, for dukkha in particular, the term usually dukkha is translated as is suffering, but that term actually doesn't do justice. Suffering does not do justice to the term dukkha. There isn't any one good word that translates dukkha. Dukkha really means, the term itself means, the ka part means wheel, and the du part means bad. So dukkha means bad wheel. It's kind of just like, you know, if you had a wheel that's just kind of got a little bit, the axle is off center, it's going to kind of roll a little bit off. It may, you know, it may not be complete suffering, it just feels like something is off. So dukkha encompasses the depth of suffering, the depths of suffering that we meet, all the way through the very subtlest kind of just feeling that something's just not quite right. So dissatisfaction, dis-ease, uncomfortableness. So dukkha itself, a lot of teachers like to use that term because it has a broader meaning. And over time, people begin to understand that term. Anicca, as far as I know, impermanence is a pretty good translation. Anatta, well, not self.
Just so much wrapped up in the concept of self.
Well, yeah, the self, not self. I think just to get your mind around the concept in general takes a lot. Even to get your mind around not self is not easy. So, I think partly the teachers use them because they're just such common words in the Buddhist vernacular that they just have been brought in, like nirvana has been brought in a sense.
Well, I've heard dukkha defined as dissatisfaction. That I really understand. Nothing really is satisfactory. But another thing I've noticed is besides the Pali terms, I think if there's a repetition of the same word over and over, i.e. skillful, arises, mindfulness. So, for example, if a teacher could say, now what are you aware of right this moment? Rather than what is your experience? Because the more I hear what is your experience, what is your experience, pretty soon it becomes meaningless. So I guess and I've said this to several teachers, change the words a little bit to keep the, say it a different way so we get it a different way. So anyway, that's kind of my general complaint.
Uh-huh.
it's not just the Pali, it's also the constant repetition of the same terms without defining them.
Right, yes, yeah. I understand that, yes. Thank you for your feedback. Anyone else have any questions before I move on? Yeah, in the back.
I'd just like to defend the Pali. Defend it into the microphone. Admittedly, for some, it must be foreign. But on the other hand, and there's different aptitudes. Some people, many teachers, you hear stories, you go to Burma and the teacher hides all the books and you just meditate all day. So there's different strokes for different folks. But in defense of the Pali, these terms are actually like constructs. And the more one hears the Dharma from different teachers, the more they become rich and nuanced. And just saying them, oh, that's dukkha, and then the whole influx of teachings you've heard, and a lot is in that term, and it becomes like a mantra.
Yes, I agree. The other piece is that different people translate these terms in different ways, and so as you explore this if you explore this in the teachings themselves, like for instance, one translator translates dukkha as stress. So he uses stress over and over and over again. That's his translation for the term dukkha. Others use suffering. And so to know, okay, that's referring to dukkha, you know, when you read one translation. Or, you know, some people use skillful and unskillful. Others use wholesome and unwholesome for the terms kusala and akusala, which are the Pali terms. So that there are, you know, if you understand the Pali and you begin to see, okay, this is what this person is talking about when they're talking about stress. They mean dukkha. So it just gives you a little bit of a window back too into the original teachings to learn a few of the selected Pali terms. And there's not that many actually that we use here. But there are some. And this is one. This is a set. Anicca, dukkha, anatta is definitely a set that we use.
We'll get used to it.
Anyone else? Question? Okay. So one other piece. Actually, there's a couple other pieces before I move on to talking about anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Each of these aspects of wisdom, the Four Noble Truths of wise understanding, the Four Noble Truths, the understanding of what's skillful and unskillful, the understanding of karma, the understanding of anicca, dukkha, anatta, and the understanding of dependent origination, all of these serves kind of a twofold role for us in the practice. So they both serve as a framework through which we can begin to understand our experience. So we explore our experience using effort, mindfulness, concentration, and kind of frame it through some of these wisdom teachings. So for instance, last week I talked about applying wise attention to understand in the present moment, this is suffering. This is the cause of suffering. This is the end of suffering. This is the path leading to the end of suffering. Using the Four Noble Truths essentially as an exploration of our experience in the present moment. So using it as a framework. We can do the same with impermanence, suffering, not self. For example, you might use impermanence as a frame of reference through which to observe your experience, consciously choosing to highlight when you notice things beginning and ending. Noticing change of seasons, reflecting on impermanence when something is broken or lost, consciously bringing that in as a reflection. So we can explore the landscape of our present moment experience through these teachings. This is using them as essentially as frameworks for understanding. This is why it's called wise understanding. And they also, these aspects also describe the insights that we experience as we engage in the practice. So we actually have insight into the Four Noble Truths. We have insight into karma. We have insight into impermanent suffering, not self. So it's important to recognize the difference. For instance, if we are engaging in an exploration of impermanence, consciously orienting our observation and experience around noticing impermanence, that conscious orientation towards that understanding is different from an insight into it. So we can sit there and notice, yes, when I cut up my food and I eat it, the food disappears. When I break something, that thing is gone. Or when I use up my gas in my gas tank, it's gone. That's impermanent. know, we can reflect on those things. That's different than having an insight into impermanence. Insight is usually accompanied by some kind of a feeling that what you're experiencing is unexpected, or it's a surprise. So you might, for instance, be paying attention to an emotion, bringing your attention to a feeling in your body, noticing anger, for instance, bringing mindfulness to the present moment experience of anger, and hanging out with it over time. You might notice it disappear. You might actually be present when it vanishes and recognize in that moment that it's kind of a shock. Where is it now? It was here just a moment ago, and now it's gone. So there's a way in which an insight has a different quality to it. It feels different. So we have insight into the Four Noble Truths, insight into understanding what's skillful, unskillful, insight into karma. These insights can be very deep, very profound, and life-altering. And often they are insights at a particular level of understanding. So we understand something about impermanence at a certain level, but maybe not all the way down to completely understanding that everything, absolutely everything in the universe, in our experience, everything is impermanent. So these understandings, again, there's that kind of layering around it, that we explore these teachings, we gain some insight, it prompts us to explore some more, and then we deepen our insight. So it's a process around letting go, a process around understanding and deepening into these insights. Would I say insight has a felt sense? It seems to. I would hesitate to say it always does. I can't think of an instance where it doesn't at this point, but much of what I've experienced in the way of insight does have a sense. It's like it's the aha effect. It's the aha. Oh, I understand. It's so obvious. How can I not see this? Kind of thing. So, anicca, dukkha, anatta. Impermanence, suffering, not self. As we get instruction in mindfulness, these are really insights that come out of the mindfulness practice. These insights into impermanence, suffering, not self. In fact, the term vipassana, which is the Pali term for what we call insight meditation, vipassana or vipassana, the two parts to that word, the we part and the passana part. The passana part means seeing clearly, and the we part apparently means something like various things. And the commentaries say that the various things that you see clearly are impermanence, suffering, and not self. So the insights in insight meditation are kind of oriented around these three aspects of experience. So as we engage in our mindfulness practice, the basic instructions of mindfulness practice are to pay attention to your experience, notice what's happening, notice the kind of characteristics of your experience, and then notice what happens to your experience. So we observe our bodily experience. For instance, you might observe pressure, vibration, heat, tingling, pulsing, or you observe emotions, you observe anger, frustration, irritation, you observe thoughts. So you observe the, for example, observing thought, you might notice that there are images, that you see images as you think, or you might notice that you hear sound as if somebody's talking to you or as if you're talking to yourself. This is getting familiar with observing the processes of the mind and body. You're getting familiar with observing the physical component of the body and the mental component of the body. And then there's the instruction about paying attention to what happens to your experience as you observe it. So the first part of the instruction, noticing the present moment experience, leads to a sharpening of mindfulness, a sharpening of ability to see clearly. The second part of the instruction, noticing what happens to your experience, begins to introduce us to what might be called the general characteristics of our experience. The first instruction is pointing us to what might be called the specific characteristics of our experience, the specificity of seeing our thoughts as images or hearing them as sound, the specificity of feeling pressure as a bunch of tingling and vibrating experience, or the specificity of feeling heaviness. So that first part is pointing us to the kind of specificity of our experience, the second part to the general characteristics of our experience. And the general characteristics of our experience are three. They are impermanent, they are suffering, they are not self. So in the present moment, as we observe our experience in the present moment, these start to become clear as actual understandings. It's no longer a thought. It's no longer an idea that something's impermanent. It's witnessed that it is impermanent, deeply witnessed. So impermanence, anicca. Everyone understands things are impermanent. This is not a surprise to people. But really deeply understanding impermanence is not something most of us really connect with. We do understand that people get old, they get sick and they die, but that's not going to happen to me anytime soon. The deep understanding of impermanence is a deep recognition of that we are impermanent, that all of our experience comes and goes. So at the ordinary level, we can see this. And actually, a reflection on the ordinary aspect of impermanence can be very transformative. Reflecting daily on the fact that you will grow old, that you are of the nature to age, that you're of the nature to sicken, that you're of the nature to die. Reflecting regularly on that aspect of impermanence can be very transformative. There's a lot of wisdom that can be gained through those simple reflections. And then as we engage in a deeper exploration through mindfulness, we start to see that even at very subtle levels, there's not anything that's permanent. I mean, what we normally think of as solid, as, you know, really here, when we start observing it with mindfulness, all of our experience just breaks up into tiny little bits. And it's just rapidly changing. As we move into a deeper state or a more continual state of meditation where mindfulness gets very, very continuous, we learn the truth of impermanence at a very deep level. It becomes very clear that there is nothing that lasts for more than a split second. This leads to insight and wisdom, because when the mind clearly, clearly understands that nothing is permanent, it stops wanting things that are just going to disappear. So the deep experiencing of impermanence leads to this wisdom. It's not simply seeing impermanent that's the point. It's really the impact it has on the mind's desire to cling. It has a very deep impact on the mind's desire to cling as it experiences just how rapidly things change. The second aspect, dukkha, suffering, unsatisfactoriness, stress, dis-ease. This is a reflection of the fact that the experiences, the things that we grasp, the things that we try to hold on to, don't actually make us happy. They don't ultimately make us happy. In large portion, because they are impermanent. We think that things in the world will make us happy. We think that if I get that thing, if I arrange my world this way, if I fix things up in such and such a way, I will be happy. And when those things change, when we've arranged something and then it falls apart, we suffer. We get something, we're happy with it for a little while, and then it kind of wears off. It's like, well, yeah, that car was great 2 years ago, but now it's just my car, you know, it's not so great, you know, it's got a few dings in it, it's costs a lot of money to maintain. So the thought that this will make me happy, you know, we actually, I think in many ways, we don't really believe that this one thing will make us happy forever. But we do believe that somehow arranging our lives such that we have one thing after another that we arrange and fix and organize, that will make us happy. And when we can't do it, we suffer. We feel like we failed, we feel like we've made a mistake, we feel like we're wrong or bad, or somehow something is wrong with the universe because we haven't been able to make our lives be just the way we want them. So, as we explore this, we start to understand that it is actually partly the wanting and the clinging that is what leads to the suffering. And this, on a meditative level, as we begin to explore our experience in a meditative way, we really start to experience our suffering very directly, very clearly. We see how what we're doing, we see not only the suffering, we see how the mind contributes to it through holding on, through wanting things to be other than they are in this moment. We endlessly want things to be different. And in our meditative understanding of this, we see how our minds contribute to this, how our mind, how our own desire for things to be different contributes to our own suffering. Now, this is not to say that we're not supposed to try to change things. I really want to make sure that's clear. This is not about saying we're not supposed to try to change things. But what it is saying is looking at what's happening now, what's happening now is what's happening now. Wishing it were some other way is suffering. That's not to say we can't act in a way to try to change the circumstances in the future. A question came up last week about attachment to results. And understanding that attachment to results is a suffering, but understanding that intellectually, but not really understanding it deeply. So this movement to change things, when we see things are happening in our world that are not, that are suffering, not only for ourselves, but for others. There's so many things in our society that do this. When we see that, we can make a movement towards change, movement towards a skillful behavior, and yet not attach to a particular outcome. So it's kind of a paradox in a way of moving towards something without attaching to it, without saying it has to be this way in the future. If we attach to a particular result in the future, if that result doesn't come to be, we will suffer. So we can move in a direction, and in fact, the whole of the spiritual practice is like this. We set our intention to move in a direction, and yet we can't attach to the outcome. We can't demand that it be at a particular time, in a particular way. It's more of a journey. At each moment, making skillful choices. At each moment, choosing to act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, as the way to maneuver towards freedom. But when, how, where, how it will manifest, we have very little control over that. So, understanding suffering doesn't mean that we simply sit there and sit in it. And it doesn't mean that we cling to some view of how it's supposed to be different. So I don't know if that, I hope that makes that kind of at least something to explore in your minds. So with the suffering in our experience, when we meet our suffering in meditation, often we just meet it. We just sit with it. It's you know, it's like, wow, we just feel it, and there's not much we can do about it. The second noble truth says, let go of the cause of suffering. Let go of the wanting. Sometimes we can't. Sometimes we feel the wanting, we feel the holding, we feel the clinging, and we have no idea how to let go of it. Just no idea. So sometimes all we get to do is observe our suffering. That's what part of our meditative experience is. The understanding of suffering is really that. Understanding what the experience of suffering is. We can't just step around it. Sometimes we have to feel it. That process itself of feeling the suffering with mindfulness, without reacting to it, without judgment. Now this is the instructions on mindfulness, bringing mindful attention to our experience without reactivity, without judgment. Can we just sit with that suffering without reacting to it? That begins to educate us. It educates us into the results, essentially, of making certain choices. So, for instance, and I'll try to keep this quick because I want to get on to the third part. In observing an emotion like anger, if you observe it over time, you may at first just feel the pain of it, feel the pain of the anger, the suffering of the anger. And then over time, as you observe more and more, you might start to see patterns that lead you into anger. And as you start to see patterns that lead you into anger, having spent time in the space of the suffering of anger, as the mind begins to see the triggers that lead you there, it begins to say, oh, I know where that's headed. I won't go there. The mind begins to let go because the mind understands that that way is suffering. So the exploration of suffering is a challenging but very important part of how the process unfolds for us.
You mentioned the three types of dukkha.
I don't have time. I might have mentioned that the first week, I think. So in terms of the insight that happens for us around dukkha, as the mind deeply understands the suffering that results from clinging, when the mind sees it's headed towards clinging, it realizes, oh, I'm not going to go there. I'm just not going to go there. So the mind starts to let go of the clinging because it understands the suffering that results. And it understands, the mind understands its own contribution to the suffering. The third, not self. So this concept is often hard for people to grasp. It's a hard concept to get your mind around. But basically, this teaching tells us that there is nothing in our experience that is stable enough, permanent enough, that exists actually longer than a split second, that can be called self. Actually, what we think of as ourselves is a process. It's a process of mind and body flowing on. And in that process of mind and body flowing on, some thoughts come up about me and mine and I. And those thoughts essentially create the idea of self. So self is really basically a thought. It's an idea. It's a belief. It's not a thing. There is no thing there to call self. So this points to the ephemeral nature of existence. Everything we experience is in a process of flux, like impermanence. There's nothing substantial to pin anything down with. It's like as anything comes into being, it's already vanishing. It's kind of like mist or vapor. There's nothing there. It's like a magic show, an illusion created because we don't see the rapidity of change. We attribute self to things because we don't see how fast things are changing. There's a distinction in my own mind between impermanence and this teaching on not self through kind of the way that we relate to our experience. When we experience impermanence of things, we, at least with respect to the insight around impermanence versus the insight around not self, when we experience impermanence of things, we might have a sense of there being something that was there and is now no longer there. When we have the insight into not self, we realize at a very deep level there's nothing there. There actually is nothing there. There's a process that's happening, but there's no thing. So sometimes people express a kind of a fear of anatta, that you know, yeah, impermanence I can wrap my mind around, but this teaching on not-self, that's kind of frightening to me. Well, we don't have, it's not something to believe, it's not something to, that you have to sign up to, actually. You don't have to believe it at all. There's one teaching that I love around this that points to just pay attention to your experience. The teaching is called the Bahiya Sutta, and it's a teaching to an ascetic named Bahiya. Bahiya came to the Buddha and said, please teach me the teachings in brief. And the Buddha said, this is how you should train yourself. In the seen will be only the seen. In the heard, only the heard. In the sensed, only the sensed. In the cognized, only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. So the Buddha says, just turn to your direct experience. Look at what is happening moment to moment. Seeing is a process. Seeing is happening. Hearing is a process. Sounds arising and passing away. Sensing, smelling, tasting, touching is a process. These things are arising, passing away. Thoughts, emotions, things cognized, these are processes. We see something, we identify it as a shape or a color or a form. That's another process arising in the mind. In the seen is only the seen, in the heard is only the heard, in the sensed only the sensed, in the cognized is only the cognized. You might call this bare attention, coming into present moment experience without adding ideas, opinions, beliefs, views onto experience. The Buddha went on to Bahiya. He said, when for you, in the seen is only the seen, the heard is only the heard, the sensed is only the sensed, and the cognized is only the cognized, then there will be no you in terms of that. When there is no you in terms of that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor yonder nor between the two. This, just this, is the end of suffering. So the Buddha pointed to this bare attention, said, pay attention to that. You don't have to believe in not-self. When you really land in your present moment experience, you will see there is no you in terms of that. There is no you there. So you don't have to believe this teaching. But I do encourage you to pay attention to your experience. Notice what you find in your experience. So as we have these insights, as we gain in our wisdom, gain in understanding, our intentions start to come into line with our wisdom. So this is wise intention, that as we understand things through the actual insight, we move towards acting out of that wisdom. And this is wise intention. Next week, I'll talk about dependent origination, which is another main wisdom teaching. And also, I will talk about the kinds of qualities that result in our minds as we become more and more free. We've talked about non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion. As we move more in that direction, there's a whole bunch of beautiful qualities that kind of come along for the ride. So I will also talk about those next week. So thank you.